Christmas is over, thank God. Christmas has come and gone, she said. I don't look forward to holidays anymore. I'll never look forward to another holiday as long as I live.
What about me? He said. I don't look forward to holidays either, believe me. Well, there's only New Year's now to get through.
You can get drunk, she said.
I'm working on it, he said, and felt the stirrings of anger. The phone rang again. It's someone wanting Charlie, he said.
What?
Charlie, he said.
Vera picked up the phone. She kept her back to Bert as she talked. Then she turned to him and said, I'll take this call on the phone in the bedroom. Would you please hang up this phone after I've picked it up in there? I can tell, so hang it up when I say.
He didn't answer, but he took the receiver.
She left the kitchen. He held the receiver to his ear and listened, but he couldn't hear anything at first. Then someone, a man, cleared his throat at the other end of the line. He heard Vera pick up the other phone and call to him, Okay, you can hang it up now, Bert. I have it. Bert? He replaced the receiver in its cradle and stood looking at it. Then he opened the silverware drawer and pushed things around inside. He tried another drawer. He looked in the sink, then went into the dining room and found the carving knife on the platter. He held it under hot water until the grease broke. He wiped the blade dry on his sleeve. Then he moved to the phone, doubled the cord in his hand, and sawed through the plastic coating and the copper wire without any difficulty. He examined the ends of the cord. Then he shoved the phone back into its corner near the canisters. Vera came in and said, The phone went dead while I was talking. Did you do anything to the phone, Bert? She looked at the phone and then picked it up from the counter. 3 feet of green cord trailed from the phone. Son of a bitch, she said. Well, that does it. Out, out, out where you belong. She was shaking the phone at him. That's it, Bert. I'm going to get a restraining order. That's what I'm going to get. Get out right now before I call the police. The phone made a ding as she banged it down on the counter. I'll go next door and call them if you don't leave now. You're destructive is what you are. He had picked up the ashtray and was stepping back from the table. He held the ashtray by its edge, his shoulders bunched. He was poised as if he were going to hurl it like a discus. Please, she said, leave now. Bert, that's our ashtray. Please, go now. He left through the patio door after telling her goodbye. He wasn't certain, but he thought he'd proved something. He hoped he'd made it clear that he still loved her and that he was jealous. But they hadn't talked. They'd soon have to have a serious talk. There were matters that needed sorting out, important things that still had to be discussed. They'd talk again. Maybe after these holidays were over and things were back to normal. He walked around the pie in the drive and got into his car. He started the car and put it into reverse. He backed out into the street. Then he put the car in low gear and went forward. The calm.
It was Saturday morning. The days were short and there was chill in the air. I was getting a haircut. I was in the chair and 3 men were sitting along the wall across from me, waiting. 2 of the men I'd never seen before, but 1 of them I recognized, though I couldn't place. I kept looking at him as the barber worked on my hair. He was moving a toothpick around in his mouth. He was heavyset, about 50 years old, and had short wavy hair. I tried to place him, and then I saw him in a cap and uniform, wearing a gun, little eyes watchful behind the glasses as he stood in the bank lobby. He was a guard. Of the other 2 men, 1 was considerably the older, but with a full head of curly gray hair. He was smoking. The other, though not so old, was nearly bald on top, and the hair at the sides of his head hung in dark lengths over his ears. He had on logging boots, and his pants were shiny with machine oil. The barber put a hand on top of my head to turn me for a better look. Then he said to the guard, Did you get your deer, Charles? I liked this barber. We weren't acquainted well enough to call each other by name, but when I came in for a haircut, he knew me and knew I used to fish, so we'd talk fishing. I don't think he hunted, but he could talk on any subject and was a good listener. In this regard, he was like some bartenders I've known.
Bill, it's a funny story. The damnedest thing, the guard said.
He removed the toothpick and laid it in the ashtray. He shook his head.
I did, and yet I didn't. So yes and no to your question.
I didn't like his voice. For a big man, the voice didn't fit. I thought of the word wimpy my son used to use. It was somehow feminine, the voice, and it was smug. Whatever it wasn't the kind of voice you'd expect or want to listen to all day. The other two men looked at him. The older man was turning the pages of a magazine, smoking, and the other fellow was holding a newspaper. They put down what they were looking at and turned to listen.
"Go on, Charles," the barber said. "Let's hear it."
He turned my head again, held the clippers a minute, then went back to work.
"We were up on Fickle Ridge, my old man and me and the kid. We were hunting those draws. My old man was stationed at the head of one draw, and me and the kid were on another. The kid had a hangover, goddamn his hide. It was in the afternoon, and we'd been out since daybreak. The kid, he was pale around the gills and drank water all day, mine and his both. But we were in hopes of some of the hunters down below moving a deer up in our direction. We were sitting behind a log watching the draw. We'd heard shooting down in the valley."
"There's orchards down there," said the fellow with the newspaper. He fidgeted a lot and kept crossing a leg, swinging his boot for a time, then crossing the other leg. "Those deer hang out in those orchards."
"That's right," the guard said. "They'll go in there at night, the bastards, and eat those green apples. Well, we'd heard shooting earlier in the day, as I said, and we were just sitting there on our hands when this big old buck comes up out of the underbrush not 100 feet in front of us. The kid saw him the same time I did, of course, and threw down and started banging at him, the knothead. The old buck wasn't in any danger from the kid, as it turns out, but at first he couldn't tell where the shots were coming from. He didn't know which way to jump. Then I got off a shot, but in all the commotion, I just stunned him."
"Stunned him," the barber said.
"You know, stunned him," the guard said. "It was a gut shot. It just stunned him, like. He dropped his head and began trembling. He trembled all over. The kid was still shooting. I felt like I was back in Korea. I shot again, but missed. Then old Mr. Buck moves off into the brush once more, but now, by God, he didn't have any of what you'd call bounce left in him. The kid had emptied his gun by this time to no purpose, but I'd hit him. I'd rammed one right in his guts, and that took the wind out of his sails. That's what I meant by stunning him."
"Then what?" The fellow had rolled his newspaper and was tapping it against his knee. "What then? You must have trailed him. Invariably, they'll find a hard place to die." I looked at this fellow again. I still recall those words. The older man had been listening all the while, watching as the guard told his story. The guard was relishing his limelight.
"But you trailed him?"
the older man asked, though it wasn't really a question.
"I did. Me and the kid, we trailed him. But the kid wasn't good for much. He got sick on the trail, slowed us down, that knothead."
He had to laugh now, thinking about that situation.
"Drinking beer and chasing all night, then thinking he can hunt deer the next day. He knows better now, by God. But we trailed him, a good trail, too. There was blood on the ground and blood on the leaves and honeysuckle, blood everywhere. There was even blood on those pine trees he leant against, resting up. Never seen an old buck with so much blood. I don't know how he kept going. But it started to get dark on us, and we had to go back. I was worried about the old man, too, but I needn't have worried, as it turns out."
"Sometimes they'll just go forever, but invariably they'll find them a hard place to die," the fellow with the newspaper said, repeating himself for good measure.
"I chewed the kid out good for missing his shot in the first place, and when he started to say something back, I cuffed him, I was so mad. Right here."
He pointed to the side of his head and grinned.
"I boxed his ears for him, that damn kid. He's not too old. He needed it."
"Well, the coyotes will have that deer now," the fellow said. "Them and the crows and buzzards."
He unrolled his newspaper, smoothed it out, and put it off to one side. He crossed a leg again. He looked around at the rest of us and shook his head. But it didn't look like it mattered much one way or the other to him. The older man had turned in his chair and was looking out the window at the dim morning sun. He lit a cigarette.
"I figure so," the guard said. "It's a pity. He was a big old son of a bitch. I wish I had his horns over my garage. But so, in answer to your question, Bill, I both got my deer and didn't get him. But we had venison on the table anyway, it turns out. The old man had got himself a little spike in the meantime. He already had him back to camp, hanging up and gutted slick as a whistle. Had the liver, heart, and kidneys wrapped in waxed paper and placed in the cooler already. He heard us coming down and met us just outside of camp. He held out his hands, just all covered with dried blood. Didn't say a word. Old fart scared me at first. I didn't know for a minute what had happened. Old hands looked like they'd been painted. "Looky," he said.
And here the guard held out his own plump hands.
"Looky here at what I've done." And then we stepped into the light and I seen his little deer hanging there. A little spike. Just a little bastard, but the old man, he was tickled to death. Me and the kid didn't have anything to show for our day, except the kid, he was still hung over and pissed off and had a sore ear.
He laughed and looked around the shop as if remembering. Then he picked up his toothpick and stuck it back into his mouth. The older man put his cigarette out and turned to Charles. He drew a breath and said,
"You ought to be out there right now looking for that deer instead of in here getting a haircut. That's a disgusting story."
Nobody said anything. A look of wonderment passed over the guard's features. He blinked his eyes.
"I don't know you, and I don't want to know you, but I don't think you or your kid or your old man ought to be allowed out in the woods with other hunters."
"You can't talk like that," the guard said. "You old asshole. I've seen you someplace."
"Well, I haven't seen you before. I'd recollect if I'd seen your fat face before."
"Boys, that's enough. This is my barber shop. It's my place of business. I can't have this."
"I ought to box your ears,"
the older man said. I thought for a minute he was going to pull up out of his chair. But his shoulders were rising and falling, and he was having a visible difficulty with his breathing.
"You ought to try it," the guard said.
"Charles, Albert's a friend of mine," the barber said. He had put his comb and scissors on the counter and had his hands on my shoulders now, as if I was thinking to spring from the chair into the middle of it.
"Albert, I've been cutting Charles's head of hair, and his boys too, for years now. I wish you wouldn't pursue this."
He looked from one man to the other and kept his hands on my shoulders.
"Take it outside,"
the invariably fellow said, flushed and hoping for something.
"That'll be enough," the barber said. "I don't want to have to be calling the law. Charles, I don't want to hear anything more on the subject. Albert, you're next in line, so if you'll just hold on a minute until I'm finished with this man. Now."
He turned to invariably.
"I don't know you from Adam, but it would help things if you'd not put your oar in again."
The guard got up and said,
"I think I'll come back for my cut later, Bill. Right now the company leaves something to be desired."
He went out without looking at anybody and pulled the door closed hard. The older man sat there smoking his cigarette. He looked out the window for a minute, and then he examined something on the back of his hand. Then he got up and put on his hat.
"I'm sorry, Bill. That guy pushed a button, I guess. I can wait a few more days for a haircut. I don't have any engagements but one. I'll be seeing you next week."
"You come around next week then, Albert. You take it easy now, you hear?"
"That's all right, Albert." The man went outside, and the barber stepped over to the window to watch him go.
"Albert's about dead from emphysema," he said from the window. "We used to fish together. He taught me everything there is to know about salmon fishing. The women, they used to just flock after him, that old boy. He's picked up a temper, though, in his later years. But I can't say in all honesty if there wasn't some provocation this morning."
We watched him through the window get into his truck and shut the door. Then he started the engine and drove away. Invariably, couldn't sit still. He was on his feet and moving around the shop now, stopping to examine everything. The old wooden hat rack, photos of Bill and his friends holding stringers of fish, the calendar from the hardware store showing pictures of outdoor scenes for each month of the year. He flipped every page and came back to October, even going so far as to stand and scrutinize the barber's license, which was up on the wall at the end of the counter. He stood first on one foot and then the other, reading the fine print. Then he turned to the barber and said,
"I think I'm going to get going too and come back later. I don't know about you, but I need a beer."
He went out quickly and we heard his car start.
"Well, do you want me to finish barbering this hair or not?"
the barber said to me in a rough manner, as if I was the cause of this. Somebody else came in then, a man wearing a jacket and tie.
Hello, Bill. What's happening?
Hello, Frank. Nothing worth repeating. What's new with you?
Nothing,
the man said. He hung his jacket on the hat rack and loosened his tie. Then he sat down in a chair and picked up Invariably's newspaper. The barber turned me in the chair to face the mirror. He put a hand on either side of my head and positioned me a last time. He brought his head down next to mine and we looked into the mirror together, his hands still encircling my head. I looked at myself, and he also looked at me. But if he saw something, he didn't ask any questions or offer any comment. He began then to run his fingers back and forth through my hair slowly, as if thinking of something else the while. He ran his fingers through my hair as intimately, as tenderly, as a lover's fingers. That was in Crescent City, California, up near the Oregon border. I left soon after. But today I was thinking of that place, Crescent City, and my attempt at a new life there with my wife, and how even then, in the chair that morning, I had made up my mind to leave and not look back. I recalled the calm I felt when I closed my eyes and let the fingers move through my hair, the sadness in those fingers, the hair already starting to grow again. Mine. During the day, the sun had come out and the snow melted into dirty water. Streaks of water ran down from the little shoulder-high window that faced the backyard. Cars slushed by on the street outside. It was getting dark, outside and inside. He was in the bedroom pushing clothes into a suitcase when she came to the door. "I'm glad you're leaving, I'm glad you're leaving," she said. "Do you hear?" He kept on putting his things into the suitcase and didn't look up. "Son of a bitch, I'm so glad you're leaving," she began to cry. "You can't even look me in the face, can you?" Then she noticed the baby's picture on the bed and picked it up. He looked at her and she wiped her eyes and stared at him before turning and going back to the living room. "Bring that back. Just get your things and get out," she said. He did not answer. He fastened the suitcase, put on his coat, and looked at the bedroom before turning off the light. Then he went out to the living room. She stood in the doorway of the little kitchen, holding the baby. "I want the baby," he said. "Are you crazy?" "No, but I want the baby. I'll get someone to come by for his things." "You can go to hell, you're not touching this baby." The baby had begun to cry, and she uncovered the blanket from around his head. "Oh, oh," she said, looking at the baby. He moved towards her. "For God's sake," she said. She took a step back into the kitchen. "I want the baby. Get out of here." She turned and tried to hold the baby over in a corner behind the stove as he came up. He reached across the stove and tightened his hands on the baby. "Let go of him," he said. get away," she cried. The baby was red-faced and screaming. In the scuffle, they knocked down a little flower pot that hung behind the stove. He crowded her into the wall then, trying to break her grip, holding on to the baby and pushing his weight against her arm. "Let go of him," he said. "Don't," she said, "you're hurting him." He didn't talk again. The kitchen window gave no light. In the near dark, he worked on her fisted fingers with one hand, and with the other hand he gripped the screaming baby up under an arm near the shoulder. She felt her fingers being forced open and the baby going from her. "No," she said, just as her hands came loose. She would have it, this baby whose chubby face gazed up at them from the picture on the table. She grabbed for the baby's other arm. She caught the baby around the wrist and leaned back. He would not give. He felt the baby going out of his hands and he pulled back hard. He pulled back very hard. In this manner, they decided the issue. Distance. She's in Milan for Christmas and wants to know what it was like when she was a kid. Always that on the rare occasions when he sees her. "Tell me," she says. "Tell me what it was like then." She sips Strega, waits, eyes him closely. She is a cool, slim, attractive girl. The father is proud of her, pleased and grateful she has passed safely through her adolescence into young womanhood. That was a long time ago. That was 20 years ago, he tells her. They're in his apartment in the Via Fabroni, near the Kashina Gardens. You can remember, she says. Go on, tell me. What do you want to hear, he asks. What else can I tell you? I could tell you about something that happened when you were a baby. Do you want to hear about their first real argument? It involves you, he says, and smiles at her. Tell me, she says, and claps her hands with anticipation. But first get us another drink, please, so you won't have to interrupt halfway through. He comes back from the kitchen with drinks, settles into his chair, begins slowly. They were kids themselves, but they were crazy in love, this 18-year-old boy and his 17-year-old girlfriend, when they married. And not all that long afterwards, they had a daughter. The baby came along in late November during a severe cold spell that just happened to coincide with the peak of the waterfowl season in that part of the country. The boy loved to hunt, you see, that's part of it. The boy and girl, husband and wife now, father and mother, lived in a three-room apartment under a dentist's office. Each night they cleaned the upstairs in exchange for their rent and utilities. In summer they were expected to maintain the lawn and the flowers, and in winter the boy shoveled snow from the walks and spread rock salt on the pavement. Are you still with me? I am, she says. A nice arrangement for everyone, dentist included. That's right, he says. Except when the dentist found out they were using his letterhead stationery for their personal correspondence. But that's another story. The two kids, as I've told you, were very much in love. On top of this, they had great ambitions, and they were wild dreamers. They were always talking about the things they were going to do and the places they were going to go. He gets up from his chair and looks out the window for a minute over the slate rooftops at the snow that falls steadily through the weak late afternoon light. Tell the story, she reminds gently. The boy and girl slept in the bedroom, and the baby slept in a crib in the living room. The baby was about 3 weeks old at this time and had only just begun to sleep through the night. On this one Saturday night after finishing his work upstairs, the boy went into the dentist's private office, put his feet up on his desk, and called Carl Sutherland, an old hunting and fishing friend of his father's. Carl, he said when the man picked up the receiver, I'm a father, we had a baby girl. Congratulations, boy, Carl said. How was the wife? She's fine, Carl. The baby's fine too, the boy said. We named her Catherine. Everybody's fine. That's good, Carl said. I'm glad to hear it. Well, you give my regards to the wife. If you called about going hunting, I'll tell you something. The geese are flying down there to beat the band. I don't think I've ever seen so many of them, and I've been going there for years. I shot 5 today, 2 this morning and 3 this afternoon. I'm going back in the morning, and you come along if you want to. I want to, the boy said. That's why I called. You be here at 5:30 then, and we'll go, Carl said. Bring lots of shells. We'll get some shooting in, all right, don't worry. I'll see you in the morning. The boy liked Carl Sutherland. He had been a friend of the boy's father, who was dead now. After the father's death, maybe trying to replace a loss they both felt, the boy and Sutherland had started hunting together. Sutherland was a bluff, heavy-set, balding man who lived alone and was not given to casual talk. Once in a while, when they were together, the boy felt uncomfortable, wondered if he had said or done something wrong because he was not used to being around people who kept still for long periods of time. But when he did talk, the older man was often opinionated, and frequently the boy didn't agree with the opinions. Yet the man had a toughness about him, and a woods knowledge that the boy liked and admired. The boy hung up the telephone and went upstairs to tell the girl about going hunting the next morning. He was happy about going hunting, and he laid out his things a few minutes later. Hunting coat and shell bag, boots, woolen socks, brown canvas hunting cap with fur earmuffs, 12-gauge pump shotgun, long john woolen underwear. What time will you be back? The girl asked. Probably around noon, he said, but maybe not until after 5 or 6 o'clock. Would that be too late? It's fine, she said. Catherine and I will get along just fine. You go and have some fun. You deserve it. Maybe tomorrow evening we'll dress Catherine up and go visit Claire. Sure, that sounds like a good idea, he said. Let's plan on that. Claire was the girl's sister, 10 years older. She was a striking woman. I don't know if you've seen pictures of her. She hemorrhaged to death in a hotel in Seattle when you were about 4. The boy was a little in love with her, just as he was a little in love with Betsy, the girl's younger sister, who was only 15 then. Joking once, he'd said to the girl, if we weren't married, I could go for Claire. What about Betsy, the girl had said. I hate to admit it, but I truly feel she's better looking than Claire or me. What about her? Betsy, too, the boy said and laughed. Of course, Betsy. But not in the same way I could go for Claire. Claire is older, but I don't know, there's something about her you could fall for. Though I believe I'd prefer Claire over Betsy, I think, if I had to make a choice. But who do you really love? The girl asked. Who do you love most in all the world? Who's your wife? You're my wife, the boy said. And will we always love each other? The girl asked, enormously enjoying this conversation, he could tell. Always, the boy said, and we'll always be together. We're like the Canadian geese, he said, taking the first comparison that came to mind, for they were often on his mind in those days. They only marry once. They choose a mate early in life, and then the two of them stay together always. If one of them dies or something, the other one will never remarry. It will live off by itself somewhere, or even continue to live with the flock, but it will stay single and alone amongst all the other geese. That's a sad fate, the girl said. It's sadder for it to live that way, I think, alone but with all the others, than just to live off by itself somewhere. It is sad, the boy said, but it's a part of nature like everything else. Have you ever killed one of those marriages? She asked. You know what I mean. He nodded. Two or three times I've shot a goose, he said. Then a minute or two later, I'd see another one turn back from the rest and begin to circle and call over the goose that lay on the ground. Did you shoot it, too? She asked with concern. If I could, he answered. Sometimes I missed. And it didn't bother you? She asked. Never, he said. You can't think about it when you're doing it. I love everything there is about hunting geese. And I love to just watch them, even when I'm not hunting them. But there are all kinds of contradictions in life. You can't think about all the contradictions. After dinner, he turned up the furnace and helped her bathe the baby. He marveled again at the infant, who had half his features, the eyes and mouth, and half the girl's, the chin, the nose. He powdered the tiny body and then powdered in between the fingers and toes. He watched the girl put the baby into its diaper and pajamas. He emptied the bath into the shower basin and went upstairs. It was overcast and cold outside. His breath steamed in the air. The grass, what there was of it, reminded him of canvas, stiff and gray under the streetlight. Snow lay in piles beside the walk. A car went by and he heard sand grinding under the tires. He let himself imagine what it might be like tomorrow, geese milling in the air over his head, shotgun plunging against his shoulder. Then he locked the door and went downstairs. In bed, they tried to read, but both of them fell asleep, she first, letting the magazine sink to the quilt after a few minutes. His eyes closed, but he roused himself, checked the alarm, turned off the lamp. He woke to the baby's cries. The light was on out there, and the girl was standing beside the crib, rocking the baby in her arms. In a minute, she put the baby down, turned out the light, and returned to bed. It was 2 o'clock in the morning, and the boy fell asleep again. But half an hour later, he heard the baby once more. This time, the girl continued to sleep. The baby cried fitfully for a few minutes and stopped. The boy listened, then began to doze. Again, the baby's cries woke him. The living room light was burning. He sat up and turned on the lamp. I don't know what's wrong, the girl said, walking back and forth with the baby. I've changed her and given her something more to eat, but she keeps crying. She won't stop crying. I'm so tired, I'm afraid I might drop her. You come back to bed, the boy said. I'll hold her for a while. He got up and took the baby, and the girl went to lie down again. Just rock her for a few minutes, the girl said from the bedroom. Maybe she'll go back to sleep. The boy sat on the couch and held the baby, jiggling it in his lap until its eyes closed. His own eyes were near closing. He rose carefully and put the baby back in the crib. It was 3:45, and he still had 45 minutes. He crawled into bed and dropped off. But a few minutes later, the baby began to cry once more, and this time they both got up, and the boy swore. For God's sake, what's the matter with you? The girl said to him. Maybe she's sick or something. Maybe we shouldn't have given her the bath. The boy picked up the baby. The baby kicked its feet and smiled. Look, he said, I really don't think there's anything wrong with her. How do you know that? The girl said. Here, let me have her. I know that I ought to give her something, but I don't know what. Her voice had an edginess that caused the boy to look at her closely. After a few minutes and the baby had not cried, the girl put her down again. He and the girl looked at the baby, then looked at each other as the baby opened its eyes once more and began to cry. The girl took the baby. "Baby, baby," she said, with tears in her eyes. "Probably it's something on her stomach," the boy said. The girl didn't answer. She went on rocking the baby in her arms, paying no attention now to the boy. The boy waited a minute longer, then went to the kitchen and put water on for coffee. He drew on his woolen underwear over his shorts and t-shirt, buttoned up, then got into his clothes. "What are you doing?" the girl said to him. "Going hunting," he said. "I don't think you should," she said. "Maybe you could go later on in the day if the baby is all right then, but I don't think you should go this morning. I don't want to be left alone with her like this." "Carl's planning on me going," the boy said. "We've planned it." "I don't give a damn about what you and Carl have planned," she flared. "And I don't give a damn about Carl either. I don't even know the man. I don't want you to go is all. I don't think you should even consider wanting to go under the circumstances." "You've met Carl before. You know him," the boy said. "What do you mean you don't know him?" "That's not the point, and you know it," the girl said. "The point is I don't intend to be left alone with a sick baby. If you weren't being selfish, you'd realize that." "Now wait a minute, that's just not true," he said. "You don't understand." "No, you don't understand," she said. "I'm your wife. This is your baby. She's sick or something. Look at her. Why else is she crying? You can't leave us to go hunting." "Don't get hysterical about it," he said. "I'm saying you can go hunting any time," she said. "Something's wrong with this baby, and you want to leave us to go hunting." She began to cry then. She put the baby back in the crib, but the baby started again. The girl dried her eyes hastily on the sleeve of her nightgown and picked her up once more. The boy laced his boots slowly, put on his shirt, sweater, and coat. The kettle whistled on the stove in the kitchen. "You're going to have to choose," the girl said. "Carl or us, I mean it, you've got to choose." "What do you mean?" the boy said slowly. "You heard what I said," the girl answered. "If you want a family, you're going to have to choose. If you go out that door, you're not coming back, I'm serious." They stared at each other. Then the boy took his hunting gear and went upstairs. He started the car after some difficulty, went around to the car windows and, making a job of it, scraped away the ice. The temperature had dropped during the night, but the weather had cleared so that stars had come out, and now they gleamed in the sky over his head. Driving, the boy glanced up once at the stars and was moved when he considered their bright distance. Carl's porch light was on, his station wagon parked in the drive with the motor idling. Carl came outside as the boy pulled to the curb. The boy had decided. "You might want to park off the street," Carl said as the boy came up the walk. "I'm all ready. Just let me hit the lights." "I feel like hell, I really do," he went on. "I thought maybe you had overslept, so I just this minute finished calling your place. Your wife said you had left. I feel like hell calling." "It's okay," the boy said, trying to pick his words. He leaned his weight on one leg and turned up his collar. He put his hands in his coat pockets. "She was already up, Carl. We've both been up for a while. I guess there's something wrong with the baby, I don't know. She keeps crying, I mean. The thing is, I guess I can't go this time." He shivered against the cold and looked away. "You should have stepped to the phone and called me, boy," Carl said. "It's okay. Shoot, you know you didn't have to come over here to tell me. What the hell, this hunting business, you can take it or leave it. It's not that important. You want a cup of coffee?" "No, thanks, I'd better get back," the boy said. "Well, since I'm already up and ready, I expect I'll go ahead and go," Carl said. He looked at the boy and lit a cigarette. The boy kept standing on the porch, not saying anything. "The way it's cleared up," Carl said. "I don't look for much action this morning anyway. It sure is cold, though." The boy nodded. "I'll see you, Carl," he said. "So long," Carl said. "Hey, don't let anybody ever tell you otherwise," Carl called after him. "You're a lucky boy, and I mean that." The boy started his car and waited, watched Carl go through the house and turn off all the lights. Then the boy put the car in gear and pulled away. The living room light was on, but the girl was asleep on the bed and the baby was asleep beside her. The boy took off his boots, pants, and shirt, and in his socks and woolen underwear, sat on the couch and read the Sunday paper. Soon it began to turn light outside. The girl and the baby slept on. After a while, the boy went to the kitchen and began to fry bacon. The girl came out in her robe a few minutes later and put her arms around him without saying anything. "Hey, don't catch your robe on fire," the boy said. She was leaning against him, but touching the stove, too.
I'm sorry about earlier, she said. I don't know what got into me, why I said those things. It's all right, he said. Here, honey, let me get this bacon. I didn't mean to snap like that, she said. It was awful. It was my fault, he said. How's Catherine? She's fine now. I don't know what was the matter with her earlier. I changed her again after you left, and then she was fine. She was just fine then and went right off to sleep. I don't know what it was. Don't be mad with us, though. The boy laughed. I'm not mad with you, don't be silly, he said. Here, let me do something with this pan. You sit down, the girl said. I'll fix the breakfast. How does a waffle sound with this bacon? Sounds great, he said. I'm starved. She took the bacon out of the pan and then made waffle batter. He sat at the table, relaxed now, and watched her move around the kitchen. She left to close their bedroom door, then stopped in the living room to put on a record that they both liked. We don't want to wake that one up again, the girl said. She put a plate in front of him with bacon, a fried egg, and a waffle. She put another plate on the table for herself. It's ready, she said. It looks swell, he said. He spread butter and poured syrup over the waffle, but as he started to cut into the waffle, he turned the plate into his lap. I don't believe it, he said, jumping up from the table. The girl looked at him, then at the expression on his face, and she began to laugh. If you could see yourself in the mirror, she said, and kept laughing. He looked down at the syrup that covered the front of his woolen underwear, at the pieces of waffle, bacon, and egg that clung to the syrup. He began to laugh. I was starved, he said, shaking his head. You were starved, she said, still laughing. He peeled off the woolen underwear and threw it at the bathroom door. Then he opened his arms and she moved into them. They began to move very slowly to the recorded music, she in her robe, he in his shorts and t-shirt. We won't fight anymore, will we? She said. It's not worth it, is it? That's right, he said. Look how it makes you feel after. We'll not fight anymore, she said. When the record ended, he kissed her for a long while on the lips. This was about 8 o'clock in the morning, a cold Sunday in December. He gets up from his chair and refills their glasses. That's it, he says. End of story. I admit it's not much of one. I was interested, she says. It was very interesting, if you want to know. But what happened, she asks. Later, I mean. He shrugs and carries his drink over to the window. It's dark now, but still snowing. Things change, he says. Kids grow up. I don't know what happened. But things do change, and without your realizing it or wanting them to. Yes, that's true, only... But she does not finish. She drops the subject, then. In the window's reflection, he sees her study her nails. Then she raises her head, asks brightly if he is, after all, going to show her something of the city. Absolutely, he says. Put your boots on and let's get underway. But he continues to stand at the window, remembering that gone life. After that morning, there would be those hard times ahead, other women for him and another man for her. But that morning, that particular morning, they had danced. They danced and then they held to each other as if there would always be that morning. And later they laughed about the waffle. They leaned on each other and laughed about it until tears came, while outside everything froze, for a while anyway. Beginners. My friend Herb McGinnis, a cardiologist, was talking. The four of us were sitting around his kitchen table drinking gin. It was Saturday afternoon. Sunlight filled the kitchen from the big window behind the sink. There were Herb and I and his second wife, Teresa, Terry we called her, and my wife, Laura. We lived in Albuquerque, but we were all from somewhere else. There was an ice bucket on the table. The gin and tonic water kept going around, and we somehow got on the subject of love. Herb thought real love was nothing less than spiritual love. When he was young, he'd spent 5 years in a seminary before quitting to go to medical school. He'd left the church at the same time, but he said he still looked back to those years in the seminary as the most important in his life. Terry said the man she lived with before she lived with Herb loved her so much he tried to kill her. Herb laughed after she said this. He made a face. Terry looked up at him. Then she said, "He beat me up one night, the last night we lived together. He dragged me around the living room by my ankles, all the while saying, 'I love you, don't you see? I love you, you bitch.' He went on dragging me around the living room, my head knocking on things.
She looked around the table at us and then looked at her hands on her glass.
"What do you do with love like that?"
she said. She was a bone-thin woman with a pretty face, dark eyes, and brown hair that hung down her back. She liked necklaces made of turquoise and long pendant earrings. She was 15 years younger than Herb, had suffered periods of anorexia, and during the late '60s, before she'd gone to nursing school, had been a dropout, a street person, as she put it. Herb sometimes called her affectionately his hippie.
"My God, don't be silly. That's not love and you know it," Herb said. "I don't know what you'd call it. Madness is what I'd call it. But it's sure as hell not love."
"Say what you want to, but I know he loved me," Terry said. "I know he did. It may sound crazy to you, but it's true just the same. People are different, Herb. Sure, sometimes he may have acted crazy. Okay. But he loved me. In his own way, maybe, but he loved me. There was love there, Herb. Don't deny me that."
Herb let out breath. He held his glass and turned to Laura and me. "He threatened to kill me, too." He finished his drink and reached for the gin bottle. "Terry's a romantic. Terry's of the kick me so I'll know you love me school. Terry, hon, don't look that way." He reached across the table and touched her cheek with his fingers. He grinned at her.
"Now he wants to make up," Terry said, "after he tries to dump on me."
She wasn't smiling.
"Make up what?" Herb said. "What is there to make up? I know what I know, and that's all."
"What would you call it, then?" Terry said. "How'd we get started on this subject, anyway?"
She raised her glass and drank.
"Herb always has love on his mind," she said. "Don't you, honey?"
She smiled now, and I thought that was the last of it.
"I just wouldn't call Carl's behavior love, that's all I'm saying, honey," Herb said. "What about you guys?" he said to Laura and me. "Does that sound like love to you?"
I shrugged. "I'm the wrong person to ask. I didn't even know the man. I've only heard his name mentioned in passing, Carl. I wouldn't know. You'd have to know all the particulars. Not in my book it isn't, but who's to say? There are lots of different ways of behaving and showing affection. That way doesn't happen to be mine. But what you're saying, Herb, is that love is an absolute?"
"The kind of love I'm talking about is," Herb said, "the kind of love I'm talking about, you don't try to kill people."
Laura, my sweet, big Laura, said evenly,
"I don't know anything about Carl or anything about the situation. Who can judge anyone else's situation? But Terry, I didn't know about the violence."
I touched the back of Laura's hand. She gave me a quick smile, then turned her gaze back to Terry. I picked up Laura's hand. The hand was warm to the touch, the nails polished, perfectly manicured. I encircled the broad wrist with my fingers, like a bracelet, and held her.
"When I left, he drank rat poison,"
Terry said. She clasped her arms with her hands.
"They took him to the hospital in Santa Fe where we lived then, and they saved his life, and his gums separated. I mean, they pulled away from his teeth. After that, his teeth stood out like fangs. My God," she said.
She waited a minute, then let go of her arms and picked up her glass.
"What people won't do," Laura said. "I'm sorry for him, and I don't even think I like him. Where is he now?"
"He's out of the action," Herb said. "He's dead."
He handed me the saucer of limes. I took a section of lime, squeezed it over my drink, and stirred the ice cubes with my finger.
"It gets worse," Terry said. "He shot himself in the mouth, but he bungled that too. Poor Carl," she said.
She shook her head.
"Poor Carl, nothing," Herb said. "He was dangerous."
Herb was 45 years old. He was tall and rangy with wavy graying hair. His face and arms were brown from the tennis he played. When he was sober, his gestures, all his movements, were precise and careful.
"He did love me, though, Herb. Grant me that,"
Terry said.
"That's all I'm asking. He didn't love me the way you love me. I'm not saying that. But he loved me. You can grant me that, can't you? That's not much to ask."
"What do you mean, he bungled it?" I asked. Laura leaned forward with her glass. She put her elbows on the table and held her glass in both hands. She glanced from Herb to Terry and waited with a look of bewilderment on her open face, as if amazed that such things happened to people you knew. Herb finished his drink. "How'd he bungle it when he killed himself?" I said again.
"I'll tell you what happened," Herb said. "He took this .22 pistol he'd bought to threaten Terry and me with. Oh, I'm serious, he wanted to use it. You should have seen the way we lived in those days, like fugitives. I even bought a gun myself, and I thought I was a nonviolent sort. But I bought a gun for self-defense and carried it in the glove compartment. Sometimes I'd have to leave the apartment in the middle of the night, you know, to go to the hospital. Terry and I weren't married then, and my first wife had the house and kids, the dog, everything. And Terry and I were living in this apartment. Sometimes, as I say, I'd get a call in the middle of the night and have to go into the hospital at 2 or 3 in the morning. It'd be dark out there in the parking lot, and I'd break into a sweat before I could even get to my car. I never knew if he was going to come up out of the shrubbery or from behind a car and start shooting. I mean, he was crazy. He was capable of wiring a bomb to my car, anything. He used to call my answering service at all hours and say he needed to talk to the doctor, and when I'd return the call, he'd say, 'Son of a bitch, your days are numbered.' Little things like that. It was scary, I'm telling you."
"I still feel sorry for him," Terry said.
She sipped her drink and gazed at Herb. Herb stared back.
"It sounds like a nightmare," Laura said. "But what exactly happened after he shot himself?"
Laura is a legal secretary. We'd met in a professional capacity, lots of other people around, but we'd talked, and I'd asked her to have dinner with me. Before we knew it, it was a courtship. She's 35, 3 years younger than I am. In addition to being in love, we like each other and enjoy one another's company. She's easy to be with.
"What happened?" Laura asked again.
Herb waited a minute and turned the glass in his hand. Then he said,
"He shot himself in the mouth in his room. Someone heard the shot and told the manager. They came in with a passkey, saw what had happened, and called an ambulance. I happened to be there when they brought him into the emergency room. I was there on another case. He was still alive, but beyond anything anyone could do for him. Still, he lived for 3 days. I'm serious, though. His head swelled up to twice the size of a normal head. I'd never seen anything like it, and I hope I never do again. Terry wanted to go in and sit with him when she found out about it. We had a fight over it. I didn't think she'd want to see him like that. I didn't think she should see him, and I still don't."
"Who won the fight?" Laura said.
"I was in the room with him when he died," Terry said. "He never regained consciousness, and there was no hope for him, but I sat with him. He didn't have anyone else."
"He was dangerous," Herb said. "If you call that love, you can have it."
"It was love," Terry said. "Sure, it was abnormal in most people's eyes, but he was willing to die for it. He did die for it."
"I sure as hell wouldn't call it love," Herb said. "You don't know what he died for. I've seen a lot of suicides, and I couldn't say anyone close to them ever knew for sure. And when they claimed to be the cause, well, I don't know."
He put his hands behind his neck and leaned on the back legs of his chair.
"I'm not interested in that kind of love. If that's love, you can have it."
After a minute, Terry said,
"We were afraid. Herb even made a will out and wrote to his brother in California who used to be a Green Beret. He told him who to look for if something happened to him mysteriously, or not so mysteriously."
She shook her head and laughed at it now. She drank from her glass. She went on,
"But we did live a little like fugitives. We were afraid of him, no question. I even called the police at one point, but they were no help. They said they couldn't do anything to him. They couldn't arrest him or do anything unless he actually did something to Herb. Isn't that a laugh?"
Terry said. She poured the last of the gin into her glass and wagged the bottle. Herb got up from the table and went to the cupboard. He took down another bottle of gin.
"Well, Nick and I are in love," Laura said. "Aren't we, Nick?"
She bumped my knee with her knee.
"You're supposed to say something now," she said, and turned a large smile on me. "We get along really well, I think. We like doing things together, and neither of us has beaten up on the other yet, thank God. Knock on wood."
I'd say we're pretty happy. I guess we should count our blessings.
For answer, I took her hand and raised it to my lips with a flourish. I made a production out of kissing her hand. Everyone was amused.
We're lucky, I said.
You guys,
Terry said.
Stop that now. You're making me sick. You're still on a honeymoon, that's why you can act like this. You're still gaga over each other yet. Just wait. How long have you been together now? How long has it been? A year? Longer than a year.
Going on a year and a half, Laura said, still flushed and smiling.
You're still on the honeymoon,
Terry said again.
Wait a while.
She held her drink and gazed at Laura.
I'm only kidding,
she said. Herb had opened the gin and gone around the table with the bottle.
Terry, Jesus, you shouldn't talk like that, even if you're not serious. Even if you are kidding, it's bad luck. Here, you guys, let's have a toast. I want to propose a toast. A toast to love. True love,
Herb said. We touched glasses.
To love, we said.
Outside, in the backyard, one of the dogs began to bark. The leaves of the aspen tree that leaned past the window flickered in the breeze. The afternoon sunlight was like a presence in the room. There was suddenly a feeling of ease and generosity around the table, of friendship and comfort. We could have been anywhere. We raised our glasses again and grinned at each other like children who had agreed on something for once. I'll tell you what real love is, Herb said finally, breaking the spell. I mean, I'll give you a good example of it, and then you can draw your own conclusions. He poured a little more gin into his glass. He added an ice cube and a piece of lime. We waited and sipped our drinks. Laura and I touched knees again. I put a hand on her warm thigh and left it there.
What do any of us really know about love? Herb said. I kind of mean what I'm saying, too, if you'll pardon me for saying it. But it seems to me we're just rank beginners at love. We say we love each other, and we do, I don't doubt it. We love each other, and we love hard, all of us. I love Terry, and Terry loves me, and you guys love each other. You know the kind of love I'm talking about now. Sexual love, that attraction to the other person, the partner, as well as just the plain everyday kind of love. Love of the other person's being, the loving to be with the other, the little things that make up everyday love. Carnal love, then, and, well, call it sentimental love, the day-to-day caring about the other. But sometimes I have a hard time accounting for the fact that I must have loved my first wife, too. But I did, I know I did. So I guess before you can say anything, I am like Terry in that regard. Terry and Carl.
He thought about it a minute and then went on.
But at one time I thought I loved my first wife more than life itself, and we had the kids together. But now I hate her guts. I do. How do you figure that? What happened to that love? Did that love just get erased from the big board as if it was never up there, as if it never happened? What happened to it is what I'd like to know. I wish someone could tell me. Then there's Carl. Okay, we're back to Carl. He loved Terry so much he tries to kill her and winds up killing himself.
He stopped talking and shook his head.
You guys have been together 18 months and you love each other. It shows all over you. You simply glow with it. But you've loved other people too before you met each other. You've both been married before, just like us. And you probably loved other people before that. Terry and I have been together 5 years, been married for four. And the terrible thing is, but the good thing too, the saving grace, you might say, is that if something happened to one of us, excuse me for saying this, but if something happened to one of us tomorrow, I think the other one, the other partner, would mourn for a while, you know, but then the surviving party would go out and love again. Have someone else soon enough, and all of this love, Jesus, how can you figure it? It would just be a memory. Maybe not even memory. Maybe that's the way it's supposed to be. But am I wrong? Am I way off base? I know that's what would happen with us, with Terry and me, as much as we may love each other. With any one of us, for that matter. I'll stick my neck out that much. We've all proved it, anyhow. I just don't understand. Set me straight if you think I'm wrong. I want to know. I don't know anything, and I'm the first to admit it.
Herb, for God's sake,
Terry said.
This is depressing stuff. This could get very depressing. Even if you think it's true,
she said,
it's still depressing.
She reached out to him and took hold of his forearm near the wrist.
Are you getting drunk, Herb? Honey, are you drunk?
Honey, I'm just talking, all right? Herb said. I don't have to be drunk to say what's on my mind, do I? I'm not drunk. We're just talking, right? Herb said. Then his voice changed. But if I want to get drunk, I will, goddammit. I can do anything I want today. He fixed his eyes on her.
Honey, I'm not criticizing,
she said. She picked up her glass. I'm not on call today, Herb said. I can do anything I want today. I'm just tired, that's all.
Herb, we love you, Laura said.
Herb looked at Laura. It was as if he couldn't place her for a minute. She kept looking at him, holding her smile. Her cheeks were flushed and the sun was hitting her in the eyes, so she squinted to see him. His features relaxed. Love you too, Laura. And you, Nick. I'll tell you, you're our pals, Herb said. He picked up his glass. Well, what was I saying? Yeah, I wanted to tell you about something that happened a while back. I think I wanted to prove a point, and I will if I can just tell this thing the way it happened. This happened a few months ago, but it's still going on right now. You might say that, yeah. But it ought to make us all feel ashamed when we talk like we know about what we're talking about when we talk about love.
Herb, come on now, Terry said. You are too drunk. Don't talk like this. Don't talk like you're drunk if you're not drunk.
Just shut up for a minute, will you? Herb said. Let me tell this. It's been on my mind. Just shut up for a minute. I told you a little about it when it first happened. That old couple who got into an accident out on the interstate? A kid hit them, and they were all battered up and not given much chance to pull through. Let me tell this, Terry. Now just shut up for a minute, okay?
Terry looked at us and then looked back at Herb. She seemed anxious, that's the only word for it. Herb handed the bottle around the table.
Surprise me, Herb, Terry said. Surprise me beyond all thought and reason.
Maybe I will, Herb said. Maybe so. I'm constantly surprised with things myself. Everything in my life surprises me. He stared at her for a minute. Then he began talking. I was on call that night. It was in May or June. Terry and I had just sat down to dinner when the hospital called. There'd been an accident out on the interstate. A drunk kid, a teenager, had plowed his dad's pickup into a camper with this old couple in it. They were up in their mid-70s. The kid, he was 18 or 19. He was DOA when they brought him in. He'd taken the steering wheel through his sternum and must have died instantly. But the old couple, they were still alive, but just barely. They had multiple fractures and contusions, lacerations, the works. And they each had themselves a concussion. They were in a bad way, believe me. And of course, their age was against them. She was even a little worse off than he was. She had a ruptured spleen, and along with everything else, both kneecaps were broken. But they'd been wearing their seatbelts, and God knows that's the only thing that saved them.
Folks, this is an advertisement for the National Safety Council, Terry said. This is your spokesman, Dr. Herb McGinnis, talking. Listen up now,
Terry said and laughed, then lowered her voice.
Herb, you're just too much sometimes. I love you, honey.
We all laughed. Herb laughed, too. Honey, I love you. But you know that, don't you? He leaned across the table. Terry met him halfway, and they kissed. Terry's right, everybody, Herb said as he settled himself again. Buckle up for safety. Listen to what Dr. Herb is telling you. But seriously, they were in bum shape, those old people. By the time I got down there, the intern and nurses were already at work on them. The kid was dead, as I said. He was off in a corner, laid out on a gurney. Someone had already notified the next of kin, and the funeral home people were on the way. I took one look at the old couple and told the ER nurse to get me a neurologist and an orthopedic man down there right away. I'll try and make a long story short. The other fellows showed up, and we took the old couple up to the operating room and worked on them most of the night. They must have had incredible reserves, those old people. You see that once in a while. We did everything that could be done. And toward morning, we were giving them a 50-50 chance, maybe less than that, maybe 30-70 for the wife. Anna Gates was her name, and she was quite a woman. But they were still alive the next morning, and we moved them into the ICU where we could monitor every breath and keep a 24-hour watch on them. They were in intensive care for nearly 2 weeks, she a little longer, before their condition improved enough so we could transfer them out and down the hall to their own rooms.
Herb stopped talking.
Here,
he said.
Let's drink this gin. Let's drink it up. Then we're going to dinner, right? Terry and I know a place. It's a new place. That's where we'll go, this new place we know about. We'll go when we finish this gin.
It's called the library,
Terry said.
You haven't eaten there yet, have you?
She said, and Laura and I shook our heads.
It's some place. They say it's part of a new chain, but it's not like a chain, if you know what I mean. They actually have bookshelves in there with real books on them. You can browse around after dinner and take a book out and bring it back the next time you come to eat. You won't believe the food. And Herb's reading Ivanhoe. He took it out when we were there last week. He just signed a card, like in a real library.
I like Ivanhoe, Herb said. Ivanhoe's great. If I had it to do over again, I'd study literature. Right now, I'm having an identity crisis. Right, Terry?
Herb said. He laughed. He twirled the ice in his glass.
I've been having an identity crisis for years. Terry knows. Terry can tell you. But let me say this. If I could come back again in a different life, a different time and all, you know what? I'd like to come back as a knight. You were pretty safe wearing all that armor. It was all right being a knight until gunpowder and muskets and 22 pistols came along.
Herb would like to ride a white horse and carry a lance,
Terry said and laughed.
Carry a woman's garter with you everywhere,
Laura said.
Or just a woman, I said.
That's right, Herb said. There you go. You know what's what, don't you, Nick?
He said.
Also, you'd carry around their perfumed hankies with you wherever you rode. Did they have perfumed hankies in those days? It doesn't matter. Some little forget-me-not. A token, that's what I'm trying to say. You needed some token to carry around with you in those days. Anyway, whatever, it was better in those days being a knight than a serf, Herb said.
It's always better, Laura said.
The serfs didn't have it so good in those days,
Terry said.
The serfs have never had it good, Herb said. But I guess even the knights were vessels to someone. Isn't that the way it worked in those days? But then everyone is always a vessel to someone else. Isn't that right, Terry? But what I liked about knights, besides their ladies, was that they had that suit of armor, you know? And they couldn't get hurt very easy. No cars in those days, man. No drunk teenagers to run over you.
Vassals, I said.
What?
Herb said.
Vassals, I said. They were called vassals, Doc, not vessels.
Vassals, Herb said. Vassals, vessels, ventricles, vas deferens.
Well, you knew what I meant anyway. You're all better educated in these matters than I am, Herb said. I'm not educated. I learned my stuff. I'm a heart surgeon, sure, but I'm really just a mechanic. I just go in and fix things that go wrong with the body. I'm just a mechanic.
Modesty somehow doesn't become you, Herb,
Laura said, and Herb grinned at her. He's just a humble doctor, folks, I said. But sometimes they suffocated in all that armor, Herb. They'd even have heart attacks if it got too hot and they were too tired and worn out. I read somewhere that they'd fall off their horses and not be able to get up because they were too tired to stand with all that armor on them. They got trampled by their own horses sometimes.
That's terrible, Herb said. That's a terrible image, Nicky. I guess they'd just lay there then and wait until someone else, the enemy, came along and made a shish kebab out of them.
Some other vassal,
Terry said.
That's right, some other vassal, Herb said. There you have it. Some other vassal would come along and spear his fellow knight in the name of love, or whatever it was they fought over in those days. Same things we fight over these days, I guess, Herb said.
Politics,
Laura said.
Nothing's changed.
The color was still in Laura's cheeks. Her eyes were bright. She brought her glass to her lips. Herb poured himself another drink. He looked at the label closely as if studying the little figures of the beef-eater guards. Then he slowly put the bottle down on the table and reached for the tonic water.
What about this old couple, Herb?
Laura said.
You didn't finish that story you started.
Laura was having a hard time lighting her cigarette. Her matches kept going out. The light inside the room was different now, changing, getting weaker. The leaves outside the window were still shimmering, and I stared at the fuzzy pattern they made on the pane and the formica counter under it. There was no sound except for Laura striking her matches. What about that old couple? I said after a minute. The last we heard, they were just getting out of intensive care.
Older but wiser,
Terry said. Herb stared at her.
Herb, don't give me that kind of look,
Terry said.
Go on with your story. I was only kidding. Then what happened? We all want to know.
Terry, sometimes, Herb said.
Please, Herb,
she said.
Honey, don't always be so serious. Please go on with the story. I was joking, for God's sake. Can't you take a joke?
This is nothing to joke about, Herb said. He held his glass and gazed steadily at her.
What happened then, Herb?
Laura said.
We really want to know.
Herb fixed his eyes on Laura. Then he broke off and grinned.
Laura, if I didn't have Terry and love her so much and Nick wasn't my friend, I'd fall in love with you. I'd carry you off.
Herb, you shit,
Terry said.
Tell your story. If I weren't in love with you, I damn sure well wouldn't be here in the first place. You can bet on it. Honey, what do you say? Finish your story. Then we'll go to the library, okay?
Okay, Herb said. Where was I? Where am I? That's a better question. Maybe I should ask that.
He waited a minute and then began to talk.
When they were finally out of the woods, we were able to move them out of intensive care, after we could see they were going to make it. I dropped in to see each of them every day, sometimes twice a day if I was up doing other calls anyway. They were both in casts and bandages, head to foot. You know, you've seen it in the movies, even if you haven't seen the real thing. But they were bandaged head to foot, man, and I mean head to foot. That's just the way they looked, just like those phony actors in the movies after some big disaster. But this was the real thing. Their heads were bandaged. They just had eye holes and a place for their mouths and noses. Anna Gates had to have her legs elevated, too. She was worse off than he was, I told you that. Both of them were on intravenous and glucose for a time. Well, Henry Gates was very depressed for the longest while. Even after he found out that his wife was going to pull through and recover, he was still very depressed. Not just about the accident itself, though of course that had gotten to him, as those things will. There you are one minute, you know, everything just dandy, then blam, you're staring into the abyss. You come back. It's like a miracle. But it's left its mark on you. It does that. One day I was sitting in a chair beside his bed and he described to me, talking slowly, talking through his mouth hole, so sometimes I had to get up to his face to hear him, telling me what it looked like to him. What it felt like when that kid's car crossed the center line onto his side of the road and kept coming. He said he knew it was all up for them. That was the last look of anything he'd have on this earth. That was it. But he said nothing flew into his mind. His life didn't pass before his eyes, nothing like that. He said he just felt sorry to not be able to see any more of his Anna, because they'd had this fine life together. That was his only regret. He looked straight ahead, just gripped the wheel and watched the kid's car coming at them. And there was nothing he could do except say, Anna, hold on, Anna.
It gives me the shivers, Laura said.
Brr,
she said, shaking her head. Herb nodded. He went on talking, caught up in it now.
I'd sit a while every day beside the bed. He'd lay there in his bandages, staring out the window at the foot of his bed. The window was too high for him to see anything except the tops of trees. That's all he saw for hours at a stretch. He couldn't turn his head without assistance, and he was only allowed to do that twice a day.
each morning for a few minutes, and every evening he was allowed to turn his head. But during our visits, he had to look at the window when he talked. I'd talk a little, ask a few questions, but mostly I'd listen. He was very depressed. What was most depressing to him, after he was assured his wife was going to be all right, that she was recovering to everyone's satisfaction, what was most depressing was the fact that they couldn't be physically together. That he couldn't see her and be with her every day. He told me they'd married in 1927, and since that time they'd only been apart from each other for any time on two occasions. Even when their children were born, they were born there on the ranch, and Henry and the missus still saw each other every day and talked and were together around the place. But he said they'd only been away from each other for any real time on two occasions. Once, when her mother died in 1940 and Anna had to take a train to St. Louis to settle matters there. And again in 1952 when her sister died in Los Angeles and she had to go down there to claim the body. I should tell you they had a little ranch 75 miles or so outside of Bend, Oregon. And that's where they'd lived most of their lives. They'd sold the ranch and moved into the city of Bend just a few years ago. When this accident happened, they were on their way down from Denver, where they'd gone to see his sister. They were going on to visit a son and some of their grandchildren in El Paso. But in all their married life, they'd only been apart from each other for any length of time on just those two occasions. Imagine that. But Jesus, he was lonely for her. I'm telling you, he pined for her. I never knew what that word meant before, pined, until I saw it happening to this man. He missed her something fierce. He just longed for her company, that old man did. Of course, he felt better. He'd brighten when I'd give him my daily report on Anna's progress. That she was mending, that she was going to be fine, just a question of a little more time. He was out of his casts and bandages now, but he was still extremely lonely. I told him that just as soon as he was able, maybe in a week, I'd put him into a wheelchair and take him visiting, take him down the corridor to see his wife.